7 p.m.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Israeli forces have opened fire on protesters in the besieged Gaza Strip, killing a teenage boy. The Israeli troops shot and killed 15-year-old Othman Rami Halas during rallies near the buffer zone that separates Gaza from Israel. They also injured 9 people, including a woman. Friday's march was in a show of solidarity with the village of Khan al-Ahmar. Residents of the West Bank village outside Jerusalem al-Quds are resisting an Israeli army plan to demolish buildings. Palestinians in Gaza have been rallying every Friday since March 30th as a part of a peaceful campaign known as the Great March of Return. Israeli forces have killed 138 Palestinians and have injured hundreds more during those rallies. Joining us live now from Gaza is Press TV's correspondent, Halal Safadi. Halal, what is the latest there?
Well,
By now, the rallies have come to an end, and today was also one day of the rallies where the Israeli forces have opened fire and used excessive force against the protesters. One person, as you mentioned, was killed. He is 15 years old, and he was shot directly in his head. So it was a clear execution of this boy. 68 others were injured today. Many of them were injured by live ammunition, and others were hit by tear gas canisters, and also they suffered from inhalation of the tear gas. So again, as you mentioned, today's rallies were there in solidarity with Khan al-Ahmar village. People here were standing, I guess, the demolishing of this village. Also, it coincides with the day 100 of the rallies. So basically, this Friday has marked the 100th day or 100th day since the beginning of the rallies. Hundreds of people were there today. And these rallies, as I said, have just come to an end. They've started rallying against the Israeli blockade and against the and or demanding the right of return to their occupied lands. Ambulances were there since the beginning of the day because of the amount of tear gas the Israeli forces have fired against the protesters. People here still insist on marching and participating in the upcoming rallies. The High Committee of the Great Return March have already called their next Friday's rally the Friday standing against the United Nations a reduction of aid to Palestinians. So again, next week they will rally again, and they will participate again to show their position and to send a message to the entire world that they will not give up on their rights.
Very well, hello. As always, we appreciate your reporting for us.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebraley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
شوف الاخر اللي كلمه في لما تسالي في لما تدرس الصبح شوف داك السمو في المول الشمال ديال الكرافون ولا شي ناس يمشيو لموريتانيا ويجي معاهم باش يلقى يزيد راه غادي يعطيو واحد من هذا واحد.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. That was Manu Chao with Clandestino. Last weekend, I reported on the collaboration between the apartheid state of Israel and Ukrainian neo-Nazis like the Azov Battalion. I also talked about Canada's collaboration with neo-Nazis in Ukraine. This week, that same apartheid state, Israel, has shot and killed another Palestinian child in Gaza. 15-year-old Othman Halas was shot and killed by Israeli snipers this Friday. 18-year-old Mohammed Nasser Shahab died in the same way and on the same day. Like all the 150 others who have died since the end of March, since the Great March of Return began, Palestinians marching in Gaza, protesting for their rights, their right to return to their land, resisting Israeli apartheid. Like those 150 others who have died, this child was unarmed. The 18-year-old was also unarmed. They were unarmed when they were brutally murdered. And just today, Saturday, Israel struck 40 targets in the Gaza City. 40 targets from their warplanes in the heaviest bombing of the area since 2014. Two more teenagers died in these airstrikes. Amir Al-Nimra, who's 15, and Loue Kuhil, 16. Two other children. That's three kids in 2 days in Gaza. For these boys, whose lives were cruelly taken away from them by a remorseless occupying army, I will observe a minute of silence. Solidarity to Othman Halas, Mohammed Nasser Shahab, Amir Al-Nimra, and Loue Kuhil. And solidarity with the Palestinian people as they bravely fight for liberation. Back in the USSR stands in solidarity with them. Tonight, I want to focus on something I've mentioned in previous shows over the past few weeks, but never actually dedicated an entire show to. And I've mentioned the barbaric detention of migrant children by American authorities, something which only recently made the news when it was revealed that children from more than 2,300 families were being forcibly separated from their parents by immigration agents before being detained en masse in what amount to concentration camps for children in the United States. Children as young as 4 have been held in cages in cold warehouses in border states. Just last month, on June 21st, Telesur reported on how one group of young migrants is now suing the U.S. government for being, quote, subjected to unconstitutional conditions that shock the conscience. Immigrant youths, some as young as 14, held in the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Detention Center in Virginia, were beaten while handcuffed, detained in solitary confinement for long periods, and kept naked inside freezing cold cells. Guards would sometimes strip them naked, restrain them in chairs, and put bags over their heads. Speaking on condition of anonymity, a former child development specialist who worked at the detention center said she saw kids with broken bones and bruises. She said they blamed the injuries on the guards, according to the Associated Press. Many of the children were transferred to the center after being accused of belonging to violent gangs, including the MS-13, Central American gang, by U.S. immigration authorities. These are not isolated incidents. This is a talk given last year by Workers' World Party, a communist party in the U.S. that has been active in solidarity work with detainees. describing the conditions in migrant detention facilities around the country. And it's pretty harrowing stuff. But it's very important to understand if you want to know the really what's going on right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On ICE detention centers. And first I'm going to talk a little bit about a specific detention center that's in Dilley, Texas. Lawyers that go to it, they call it baby jail. It is a place where women and children are held. Men, when they're crossing the border, they're split from their families. And men and boys over 18 are taken into separate facilities. And so Dilley is one exclusively for women and children. When you walk in, there's a room called the hielera. It's called the fridge. And people are always sick. There's very limited health care. There's not enough doctors, there's not enough nurses, and there isn't enough medication for the people that do get seen. So women are often just seen holding their sick children. And the average stay is about 3 weeks. If you're there for 4 to 5 weeks, you usually get transferred to Burke Detention Center, which is in Pennsylvania. And people will stay there for months, sometimes years. There's children who are in there right now that have had at least two birthdays in there. There was recently a lawsuit that went through to challenge child detentions. And the outcome was that it's illegal to hold children for over 21 days. So you can legally hold a child up for 3 weeks, but obviously this is violated all the time. Sometimes they say it's so that parents and children can stay together. So if the mom is staying longer, they'll say that that's why the child is staying. But really it should be the other way around, that both of them get released at the same time. There's also a big issue where people who get their paperwork that goes through, sometimes they're still not released. So lawyers will go through all of the documents and they'll see that this person should have been released, but for some reason they're still in the detention center, and so they'll have to go through another legal process of trying to get them out and figuring out how they fell through the cracks and why they fell through the cracks. There's really no justification for detaining a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old. There's no justification for detaining any of these people. There aren't individual findings for anyone in Dilley and why they should be there. The only reason they're there is purely because they crossed the border without documentation and were caught. Most of these people who are crossing the border are crossing to try and get asylum. They're fleeing poverty and violence, often in South America, and we know that this poverty and violence is caused by the U.S. Asylum cases are very strange because they require you to be physically in the U.S., but you can't have documents already. So there is no other way other than to come and cross without papers. If someone does get a visa, which can take years and years and is a very difficult process, if you do get a visa and you come and once you're inside you try to apply for asylum, you can be charged with visa fraud. You also, if that doesn't happen, the criteria for getting a visa and how you were approved, that's going to be grounds for your asylum case not to be approved. So the system is really rigged on every single level. And detention centers are a horrifically perfect place for labor super exploitation. The women that work that live at Dilley, they aren't working, but CoreCivic, which is the corporation that runs for-profit prisons and detention centers, they get paid by how many beds they have. So Dilley has 2,400 beds. Right now there's only 500 people in there, which is good compared to how many there could be in there, but CoreCivic still gets paid on the number of beds, not based on how many people are there. So really it's just an incentive for them to keep building and building more prisons and detention centers regardless of how many people are in them. Last fall there was a proposal for 4 to 5 more detention centers to be built, one of them actually very near where I grew up. And often these detention centers and prisons as well will appeal to communities saying that they will bring jobs if they're allowed to build their detention centers there. But really all they do is bring fear for immigrant communities and push confidence for white supremacists in the area. In most other detention centers, ones that are predominantly men, prisoners are forced to work. There's one in Aurora, Colorado, a detention center where prisoners were forced to clean, maintain, and operate a 1,500-bed facility. And GEO, which is an organization like CoreCivic, pays them $1 a day or nothing, calling it volunteer work. if they don't do this volunteer work, they're threatened with being put in solitary confinement or with being put in physical restraints. So it's really not volunteer work in any way. There's another detention center in Georgia where detainees are held in unsanitary, inhumane, and isolated conditions even when they are working. And they're forced to work full time for $1 to $3 a day. Food is also scarce, so often workers will choose to work in the kitchen because it means that they have better access to food. And the ICE vendor contracts repeatedly cite voluntary work, but there's no way that the prisoners can really say that they're not going to do this if they want to be fed or not be in solitary confinement, and really if they want to survive. The U.S. and its capitalist economy is at a dead end. One of the ways it manages to stay afloat is by expanding the number of super exploited workers that it has access to. So by building more prisons and more detention centers where workers, primarily people of color, are super exploited behind closed doors, or rather behind barbed wire. Detainees are fighting back. There's one example in the Northwest Detention Center, it's in Tacoma, Washington, where prisoners held 7 hunger strikes last year in 2017. At one point, it's pretty amazing. At one point, there were 750 prisoners that were all striking at the same time. There are so many stories to tell of families that are reunited, of prisoner solidarity, but also of guard brutality, of laws dictating that lawyers and other people coming into detention centers can't touch or hold crying babies or hug mothers, of starvation and of overwork, of exploitation. But the prisoners are fighting, and so are we, and they're not waiting for the legal system to make it easier for them. They're taking it into their own hands. Because prisons and detention centers are really two sides of the same coin, I want to end with the chant of La migra, la policía, la misma porquería. So if we can all do it together. La migra, la policía, la misma porquería. La migra, la policía, la misma porquería. Thank you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. That's the conditions that the prisoners are facing in ICE detention facilities in the United States, in detained migrants. And I want to reiterate before I get it. There's something I really want to talk about. Of course, the speaker there from Workers World Party talked about how the U.S. is responsible, like, for the poverty and violence that goes on in Central America, and why so many people want to migrate northwards to the U.S. and to Canada. But I want to reiterate something I said in previous shows, something I've talked about. After the separation of migrant children from their families made international headlines, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave his usual lukewarm criticism of the Donald Trump administration and said something to the effect that, quote, this is not the way we do things in Canada. And he's lying, blatantly lying. As I've talked about previously, in recent years, Canada has detained hundreds of migrant children from the Middle East, West Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean. In February 2017, the Invisible Citizens, Canadian Children in Immigration Detention study, produced by the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Law, revealed that there were 48 children being detained at that time in the Toronto Immigration Holding Center alone, including infants and toddlers. Putting migrant children behind bars is not just an American phenomenon. And that's something that needs to be stressed. Canada does not have clean hands here, and very notably continues to classify the United States as a safe country for refugees to go to. Meaning that if somebody comes from the U.S. applying for asylum in Canada, that will be rejected because America is, quote, a safe country. And of course, you know, if you paid attention at all to what I've been saying at the beginning of the show, you'll know why that is not true. Now, many of the Central American migrants who have reached Canada and the U.S. are fleeing truly brutal violence in their homelands. To give you some illustration of this, in the campaign leading up to the July 1st general elections in Mexico, more than 111 candidates were murdered. Candidates assassinated in that campaign, which kicked off in last fall. Due to the escalation of the so-called war on drugs in Mexico, literally tens of thousands of people have died in that country since 2006. In 2016, 23,000 died in Mexico as a result of drug violence, making it the world's second deadliest conflict zone after Syria. By comparison, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan claimed 17,000 and 16,000 lives, respectively, in 2016. The drug war in Mexico really began in late 2006 when former President Felipe Calderón unleashed the military on the country's drug cartels, a move that was immediately backed by a $1.8 billion military aid package by former U.S. President George W. Bush. Washington provided further annual drug war aid to Mexico through the Merida Initiative ever since that time. So the U.S. has its hands all over the violence in Mexico. You know, and the militarization of the police, militarization of society, the constant bloodshed between cartels, between the police, the army, all this stuff. The U.S. has its hands all over that violence. It's funding that violence. It's providing aid that encourages that violence, drives that violence, which is driving many people to flee Mexico and flee northwards. But Mexico's not alone in the poverty and violence. Honduras, in particular, has been a major source for refugees heading north to the U.S. border. It's important to remember that this is a country that has been crushed, literally crushed, by American imperialism, going back more than a century. Even in 1914, American banana interests controlled more than 1 million acres of that country's best land. And peasants were evicted from that land to make way for cash crop plantations. And that, of course, was made possible by military force. In 1907 and 1911, the U.S. Marines directly intervened in Honduras, occupied that country, in order to secure and expand the holdings of United Fruit Company and other U.S. agribusiness interests, agribusiness firms. And the Honduran ruling class was and remains completely dependent on U.S. support in order to maintain the deeply unequal society that it benefits from and what the U.S. benefits from. By the 1980s, when hundreds of U.S. soldiers were stationed in that country to train contra-terrorists who were then launching bloody cross-border attacks on socialist Nicaragua, you know, this massive destabilization campaign, attempted regime change campaign that the U.S. was running at that time, U.S. political and military policy was so influential in Honduras that many people referred to that Central American country as, quote, the USS Honduras and, quote, the Pentagon Republic. And, of course, there's U.S. bases in Honduras to this day. The Reagan years also saw the construction of numerous joint military bases and installations. And such moves greatly strengthened the militarization of Honduran society. In turn, political repression rose, really skyrocketed during those years. There was a dramatic increase in the number of political assassinations, disappearances, and illegal detentions. Under these conditions, economic austerity was imposed, and traditional forms of agriculture were even further undermined. Peasants lost their land. They were driven from their land. Plantations, cash crop economy was expanded, while an already weak social safety net was basically torn up. And it was in this context that emigration from Honduras to the United States would dramatically increase, starting in the 1990s. And it looked like the situation might change in 2006 with the election of left-wing reformist Manuel Zelaya to the presidency, who tried to really care to modest reform program. He tried to rebuild the social safety net, raise the minimum wage, and reform the constitution in a progressive direction. But for his efforts, he was overthrown, of course, in a U.S.-backed military coup in 2009. And this is where the emigration crisis really begins. Since the coup, writes historian Dana Frank, quote, a series of corrupt administrations has unleashed open criminal control of Honduras from top to bottom of the government. Politically motivated killings and assassinations are common, organized crime and drug traffickers work hand in glove with the police, and the country is the most dangerous place in the world, to be an environmental activist, according to Global Witness. The social safety net has collapsed entirely, and poverty is skyrocketing. Even as global investors are given a free hand in the country and corporate profits are soaring. And all of this is mainly the result of U.S. foreign policy over the last 100 years, which has really created an El Dorado for vicious and unregulated capitalism in Central America, in which an environment in which human needs don't factor at all. This is why people are running away and leaving their homes behind. And these are the desperate people that the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known as ICE, detains and brutalizes in their concentration camps and detention centers. Refugees that the U.S. itself created. Now, the following is another shocking report that was aired recently on the Real News Network about the conditions in these places. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Ben Norton. The world has been shocked in recent weeks by images of young immigrant children torn away from their families at the southern border of the United States. In audio recordings obtained by journalists, children can be heard screaming for their parents.
No, Baba. Baba.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection is putting these children in cages where temperatures are sometimes freezing and they have nothing but a space blanket. And there are also reports of widespread physical abuse and even sexual assault of these detained children. Yet at the same time, dogs in the custody of Customs and Border Protection get lavish treatment at a pet resort contracted by the DHS. Ken Klippenstein, an investigative reporter with the Young Turks, recently revealed this in a report titled, As DHS Puts Children in Cages, Guess Where They're Putting Dogs. We're joined by Ken today to talk about this shocking story. Thanks for joining us, Ken.
Hey, Ben. Thanks so much for having me.
So can you talk a bit more about this story? And you mentioned in the report you reviewed public records and the DHS is contracting a pet resort where dogs are sleeping inside in temperature-controlled doggy suites. And you mentioned they have maid service and, quote, plush double-sided sheepskin bedding, end quote, while at the same time children detained by the same U.S. government department are put in cages.
Yeah, there's sort of a darkly comic quality to it, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, the president has called, many of these immigrants, quote, animals. That may have been too kind of rhetoric for him, given that, at least in this instance, they treat them worse than animals, than dogs. As you point out, reputable human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch has in the past reported that, detainees in ICE or DHS custody, rather, have been made to sleep on concrete slabs, freezing cold temperatures, they've reported. And these are, a number of different reports, not just a few individuals. And so when you compare that with the treatment of dogs in DHS custody, unfortunately, the records didn't say whether these were service dogs or, dogs that they obtained, in the course of any other, activities. But it did say, as you point out, that they were given plush bedding, they have maid service. Unfortunately, these aren't things that actual humans would appear to be entitled to with the DHS.
Yeah, and actually here at The Real News, I recently interviewed Nino Brown, who's an organizer with the Jericho Movement, which is a movement to advocate for the rights of political prisoners here in the U.S. And he talked about how at a prison in Massachusetts, where Malcolm X had previously been held, in fact, there are detainees who are being forced to drink polluted water that is polluted with different chemicals, while dogs that they're training at the prison get water bottles. So this is certainly widespread. It's symptomatic of larger issues. So can you talk a bit more about your reporting and then also the reporting we've seen in recent weeks on the detention of these children by CBP and also you can mention ICE?
Well, to talk a little bit more about it, I mean, the dogs are even permitted more outdoor playtime than these children detainees are. So the children detainees are only allowed out 2 hours out of the day, according to reporting that, has come out in the last couple of weeks. Dogs can have up to 4 hours. So it's twice as much time as children can have. And I mean, you know, how much kids need to be able to exercise. Any child psychologist can tell you that's absolutely crucial. It's not the same as an adult. You need to go outside and get exercise, although, of course, we need that as well. And so I just thought that was kind of striking. Once again, you know, in light of his comments about, you know, immigrants being animals, that he's treating them even worse than that. I think we should all sort of reflect on the Zimbardo prison studies and what we might take back from that in terms of what we could anticipate to be, you know, treatment of individuals who have far less power than you know, guards that are watching over them. That being completely aside from the really quite inflammatory rhetoric on the part of the president that may even empower, you know, undesirable activity of that sort.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if we could conclude here talking a bit about how this policy actually is not entirely new, although it's completely shocking. And there's no question that it's gotten worse in recent years as the Trump administration has given CBP and ICE carte blanche to do whatever they want. But this actually really goes back to the post 9/11 war on terror era that we're in. The Bush administration created the Department of Homeland Security, under which ICE and now CBP are part of the U.S. government's department. And we've seen, you know, under the Bush administration, also under the Barack Obama administration, an intensification of a kind of war on immigrants, massive deportations, record levels of deportations, and the Trump administration has continued to exacerbate this. As a reporter, Ken, you've focused a bit on the Trump administration and also the Obama administration. I'm wondering if you can reflect on how this is bipartisan policy that has gotten even worse under Trump.
That's absolutely right. There's been an intensification of it, but there's no question that, I mean, you know, ICE didn't exist 30 years ago. This is a new institution. And so when people say, you know, maybe we ought to get rid of ICE entirely, I don't see that as, you know, that wouldn't seem to be such a radical policy given that it didn't exist not that long ago. People have this idea that, you know, perhaps this is an institution that, you know, was enshrined in the Constitution or maybe at least in the post-war period. And that's just not true. And going back to Obama, yeah, there were, you know, there were significant rights groups that were calling him, quote, the deporter in chief. So while Trump certainly is pursuing, you know, these policies with a more, you know, much more aggressively than his predecessor did, there's no question that Obama laid the groundwork for these kind of things to happen. So, yeah, any solution, I think, has to take into account that fact and the fact that they really, you know, he had a powerful congressional majority and the Democratic Party, you know, it would seem that a big part of their constituency would be, you know, people who have family who might be impacted by these ICE policies. So I think it's really sort of scandalous that they didn't tackle those things when they had the chance. Now, of course, the Democrats are, I think, essentially irrelevant at this point, given that they, you know, control none of the bodies of government. And so in that sense, we sort of have to deal with what's in front of us, I think. But there's certainly a history there.
Well, thank you for joining us. We were speaking with Ken Klippenstein, who is an investigative reporter who contributes to The Young Turks and also The Daily Beast. We were discussing a shocking new report he has titled, "As DHS Puts Children in Cages, Guess Where They're Putting Dogs." Thanks for speaking with us, Ken.
Hey, thanks so much, Ben.
For The Real News, I'm Ben Norton.
You're listening to Back in the USSR, and I don't think I need to say anything more about that that last report. I mean, that's an atrocity, you know, what was discussed there. You know, a crime against humanity. But if you, as Ben Norton talked about in that report, if you believe the mainstream media, you know, notorious for its lack of context, you'd be forgiven for thinking that this harsh crackdown, harsh treatment of immigrants, and the separation of families was all the product of the uniquely evil genius of Donald Trump, and that it's some kind of aberration, that he somehow represents some kind of aberration in recent American history. This, of course, is nonsense. A good article to read and to consider, which blows the mainstream narrative out of the water, was written in The Nation magazine by Marissa Franco and Carlos Garcia in June 2016, entitled "The Deportation Machine Obama Built for President Trump." The article says of Obama, quote, "When he leaves office, he will leave behind to his successor the most sophisticated and well-funded human expulsion machine in the history of the country. End quote. And it talks about, the article talks about how before the end of his first term in office, Obama had expanded ICE and the migrant detention deportation apparatus he had inherited from George W. Bush by a shocking 3,600%. His director of the Office of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, expanded the purview of his department to include an immigration enforcement plan that sought to achieve a, quote, 100% removal rate of the undocumented population in the United States by seeing to the drafting of a document that came to shape the next 15 years called Endgame, Endgame Office of Detention and Removal Strategic Plan. You know, whose goal was to remove all undocumented people in the U.S. And that happened under Obama. To pay for the ballooning enforcement first approach, the budget for immigration enforcement grew 300% from the resources given at the time of its founding under Bush to $18 billion, more than $18 billion annually, more than all the other federal law enforcement agencies' budget combined. So ICE basically became the most powerful, the most well-funded law enforcement agency in the entire United States. And of course, as it became more and more powerful, as it gained more funding, more personnel, record numbers of people were being deported, and an increasing number were also charged and channeled into federal prison before their expulsion. Within 2 years of coming into office, President Obama doubled the number of people being prosecuted for re-entry, for illegal re-entry into the United States after being detained, by expanding Bush's border court system, Operation Streamline, which tries up to 70 people per day in a cattle line of sentences. You know, it's like they basically just try them like one after another as like almost in a chain, just boom, you know, they're just like processing these people. The experiment went from, basically this entire thing went from three jurisdictions, happening in three jurisdictions in the U.S. in 2008, to every single border sector except California by 2010, and from the time of its invention in 2005 to just 4 years later in 2009, Streamline sent over 209,000 individuals to serve federal prison sentences for no reason other than crossing the border. And this article concludes, quote, as Obama enters his final months, because remember this was 2016, as Obama enters his final months, some say the record deportations he oversaw and the raids against refugee mothers and children, already seal his legacy as the deporter in chief. I want to replay now a report from The Real News I aired a couple of weeks back dealing with this, just to emphasize its significance. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Greg Wilpert. The debates and controversies around President Trump's immigration policy has become one of the country's predominant issues. On the one side, we have the Republicans and Fox News supporting Trump's family separation policy, the indefinite detention of immigrant families, and now possibly the denial of due process rights for immigrants. On the other hand, we have the Democrats and liberal news outlets presenting the Trump administration's inhumanity with regard to these policies. A recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review, however, titled Politics Pushes Central American Voices Out of Child Separation Coverage, argues that what most media outlets are missing is not only the voices of immigrants and longtime immigration experts, but also lack a historical perspective on the immigration debate. Joining me now is the article's author, Roberto Lovato. Roberto is a writer working out of the San Francisco Writer's Grotto and has either worked on or reported on Central American refugee issues for almost 30 years. Thanks for joining us today, Roberto.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
So let's start with what the media coverage of the Trump administration's policies, immigration policies, has been like and how it has evolved. In your article, you suggest that there was a transition at some point from being relatively uncritical to being far more critical. What was this transition about?
Well, the transition from being not critical of the president to being critical takes place from not just the last 2 weeks, but from the last 10 years, from the Obama era to the Trump era, where I've spoken to people who were detained this last week, people that were not detained, they were in prison. They don't even use the word detained. And people like a woman I interviewed named Ana Luna, whose name I had to change because she wanted me to. Ana told me that she noticed how suddenly, quote, they're critical of the president, unquote, when they weren't, meaning they, the media. So there's a night and day treatment in terms of how President Obama was treated in separating and jailing children and their mothers, to Donald Trump's separating and jailing children and their mothers. I mean, the reporting would have us believe that Donald Trump's actions take place kind of Deus ex machina, the God in the machine comes out from on high and suddenly comes down on us, Hitler blitzkrieg like, and oh my God, people start crying oceans of tears. When, in fact, among Central Americans, like Ana, or like the advocates and scholars that are covering this issue for more than a decade, 20 years, even 30 years among some of us, there's been a lot of tears and oceans of tears as well. But somehow, the part that cried because of what the Democrats and Obama did to these imprisoned migrants and children, people put in tents, kids separated from their mothers. About 5,000 children were separated from their mothers and put in foster care, and mothers and fathers, and put in foster care by the Obama administration in 2011 alone. This, according to an important study by Seth Fried Wexler when he was at Race Forward. So we see a disparity in the coverage when there's a similarity in the treatment, a similarity that's not even made, right? They put like a wall between what Trump is doing as something utterly new and what Obama did, which is somehow a gentler, kindler form of, say, shrinking children's brains when they're in these immigrant prisons, as their psychologist told me happens after 6 weeks, or as if the trauma of a mother like Ana, separated by the Obama administration, or imprisoned by the Obama administration, exposed to conditions that drove some children and migrants to attempt suicide, to slit their wrists, to try to hang themselves, as if all that is kind of gentler and kindler than what Donald Trump is doing. It's astonishing, really, the layers of dehumanization, the different kinds of dehumanization.
So considering that now that there's a lot more outrage and intensity in coverage, wouldn't you say this is a good thing? I mean, for example, Time Magazine, of course, what's missing is this earlier coverage, but I'm saying, isn't it something positive to consider that now there's much more, that there is at least a focus on it? For example, when Time Magazine juxtaposed a crying Honduran immigrant child, a toddler basically, with a towering figure of Donald Trump, who was saying, "Welcome to America." What's your response to the use of this kind of imagery and this kind of coverage?
Well, I think there is some good to be had in the fact that a story that's more than 10 years old of child separation, Central American child separation, and the jailing of Central American children and mothers is now coming out. You know, what Central American scholars and Central American activists and Central American community have known in the Obama era, now everybody's getting to know in the Trump era. The problem is, again, that it's being narrated as if this didn't happen in the Obama era. And that's, I think, very dangerous in terms of, say, the way that that Time magazine cover story that you mentioned, where they have a Trump standing over a child. They literally cut and paste the image of a crying girl who was not separated from her mother and put it on the cover next to Trump. So that's almost metaphoric of the way that I think liberal media and I think liberal progressive organizations are cutting and pasting and objectifying Central American identity, Central American pain, in what one scholar called violence porn, to use for political ends. So there's an objectification of migrants by the reactionaries, and there's an objectification of the Central American children and mothers by liberals and progressives, where basically the image of Central Americans that prevails, because you don't have any Central American voices except the crying voice, the crying voice of a mother, the crying voice of a child. So Central Americans in the narrative have been reduced to images and sounds and sound bites of pain. They don't, we don't, because my family's from El Salvador, full disclosure. We don't appear as fighters. I mean, in El Salvador, something on the order of 1/3 of all Salvadorans were organized against the state during the war, according to the Central American University. I mean, you have people that have a ferocious will to fight, as any labor union in the United States will tell you. You would know it from the way the media coverage of Central American child separation is being told. It's being told primarily through the lens of a liberal progressive media that is protecting Barack Obama at all costs from the heat of this major intense issue that stirs a lot of emotions. So it's no coincidence that instead of Central, it seems that the expertise among Democratic Party operatives and Obama, ex-Obama officials, is greater than that of Central Americans, because they appear exponentially more than Central Americans do. In fact, Central Americans don't appear in a single, not one, ni uno, ni un articulo about the Central American separation, child separation story of the last few weeks. This raises the question, what are people actually crying about, right? Because that image is not backed up. Those sounds aren't backed up by context, by storytelling from people who are more complex than just crying and suffering. That story is not backed up by scholars who spent their lifetimes analyzing and studying this. That story is being backed up by Democratic Party operatives, liberal media, who basically cut and paste images and sounds of Central American suffering and pain and put it up for mass consumption in order to beat up Donald Trump and cover for Barack Obama.
Well, actually, speaking of the covering for Barack Obama and the lack of historical context, I mean, what would you say are the consequences of leaving that type of historical context out of the picture? I mean, is it that Obama's policies directly contributed to an intensification, perhaps, of the Trump administration's policies, or would you say that they're basically the same?
Well, as far as separating children, Barack Obama separated children from their mothers. As far as putting children in tents, Barack Obama put children in tents. He separated thousands of children from their mothers. 2011 alone, more than 5,100 children were separated from their mothers and fathers and put in foster care. Again, that's according to Race Forward. You can look at a story by McClatchy that basically confirms this as well. So when you don't report that and you put it all on Donald Trump, you basically don't really want to look at the policy foundation for this truly terrifying action by Donald Trump and those of Barack Obama. Because when I interview Ana Luna, she's describing to me twitching in the face, women who try to slit their wrists, boys who try to hang themselves, you know, twitching arms involuntarily, all signs of trauma and extreme layers of trauma, according to psychologists I've interviewed. So when you don't have a historical accounting of that, you're basically allowing that to be normalized in the, say, the national unconscious of the United States, in the political unconscious of the United States. And so we are all being brought into, by Donald Trump, but also by the Democrats, into normalizing this kind of policy and treatment, because it goes kind of really notice when an evil bad guy who's, you know, I would say it's like the Jungian shadow of the United States, but then covered up by what I would call the denial mechanism that is the Obama administration and the Democratic Party with respect to Central American children and mothers.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. I was speaking to Roberto Lovato, a longtime writer on Central American refugee issues and author of the recently published Columbia Journalism Review article, Politics Pushes Central American Voices Out of Child Separation Coverage. Thanks for joining us today, Roberto.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
And thank you for joining the Real News Network. Also, if you like stories such as this one, I want to remind you that we recently started our summer fundraiser and need your help to reach our goal of raising
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're on CFRU. And I think as that that report on the Real News definitely stresses, really drives home, America has a deeper problem than just one man with a bad attitude, one president with a bad attitude. If America's first black president, Barack Obama, could pursue such an inhumanly racist policy towards migrants from Latin America, you know, family separation, the works. I think it's clear for all to see that capitalist America itself is systemically racist. Just as the black men and women, you know, got targeted by the cops with impunity in the streets of Ferguson and other cities, found out during the Obama years, having a black man in the White House doesn't change that fundamental fact that America is systemically racist. Certainly for the Central American migrants fleeing the effects of the of American foreign policy in places like Honduras, where the military coup in 2009 was fully backed by the Obama administration. For them, Obama was not a savior, but a sign of what was to come under his successor. He was more like a preview to the blatant fascism, blatant white supremacy that we see now. When you have fascist institutions like ICE working hand in glove with private prison contractors like Geo Group, who literally profit from the misery of detained migrants, and you have a situation where half of California's LGBTQ caucus in the state assembly accept money from these private prison contractors, you're dealing with an incredibly sick society where even so-called progressives are corrupted by structures of racism and exploitation. And this is why socialist revolution is a necessity all over this continent and all over the world. I don't think I could make that point any clearer. This system must be stopped. It must be broken down. Capitalism, imperialism, settler colonialism, it all has to be overthrown, and a socialist system centered on human needs and human liberation must be built in its place. The only alternative is fascist barbarism. We must win. Brothers and sisters, we must win. We have to defeat this system, or it will consume us. It will consume everything. And this is why we fight. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
promised I would rap like a superstar rap. Spit like a monster, put myself on the map. First rap in English, then rap in Spanish. Que lo que tú dices, boy, I cause damage. International, worldwide, resistance in my lyrics. Walking down these mean streets to the house of spirits. Yo represento lo que canto mis canciones. Amor, justicia, hip hop, revoluciones. Listen here, we done preaching to the choir. We stayed on the block, took the neighborhood higher. I guess I just listened to the little